If you're looking for the perfect gift, you're covered with a gift that's sure to wow. Taste of Chicago ships Lou Malnati's legendary deep dish pizzas nationwide. Plus, they ship other Windy City favorites too. Visit tastesofchicago.com to order today.
All right, Reg. How are you doing, my friend? We are getting to the end of the year here. This is the... Is this the last one? No. No, this isn't the last one. We have one more until the end of the year, right? Yeah, we're still... I know I'm trying to rush it, trying to get to 2025. No. I get it. But it is... This is the Christmas week. That's for sure. Yeah. So, anyway, are you all set to get your presents all shopped for and everything? Good. All right. Well, let's also check our list. Get a little check off the Christmas list is to do the podcast for this week. All right. Very good, sir. You set to go? Trigger finger ready? Put in the book 448, number 448. And I'll give you star, smile strong, and I'll give you 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget, listening is important, but getting out there and telling your friends and telling your family and telling anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic is also important, too. Give the gift of podcasts this Christmas. Of course, if you like what you're hearing and what you've been listening to for several years, or maybe just several months, or maybe even just one day, whatever it is, you go to WGNRadio.com, you go to the podcast section, you click that on, you go to the prompt for this specific podcast, Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and there you will find podcast after podcast after podcast. It's always good to listen to where we've been so you know where we're going. We've been going strong since 2016. If I had a t-shirt for this podcast, it would say Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic established 2016. You know how they have that? That's what I would have. We're establishing right now episode number 448, inching up ever so close to that magic number of 450. I don't know why that's magic, but it is. Anything with a zero or a five. So, yes, we are in Christmas week right now. This podcast is posting on the 23rd. So have a happy holiday season. We will be doing lots of reflection, I am assuming, both individually as well as collectively as a society over the next couple of weeks, looking back on the year and just seeing what happened. It's always fun to do that, and especially when you look back to January and you say, oh, gosh, that was just this year that happened? Yeah. But... what I want to talk about today goes back many years, not just this year. In my case, it goes back decades. When I was 9 years old, my family and I went to Hawaii, Oahu, if you will, the majorly populated island of the time. And this is back in the 70s. And I have traveled, if you've listened to this podcast over the years or on me on the radio, you know that, especially since I've been married over the last more than three decades, my wife and I have traveled quite a bit. And we have been And then my little adventures with seeing Elton John concerts and also seeing Bruce Springsteen concerts and different kind of events like that. I have traveled throughout the country. Haven't hit all 50 states yet. I still have about 10 more states to go. I think less than 10. And my goal is to get that done. I don't know where that gets logged in. I don't know if there's any official designation. But, you know, it's interesting. We've got 50 of them. It's a nice number, nice round number. I just talked about that. We love numbers with zeros and fives at the end. So the United States has a nice 50 states. And so I have a few left to go. When I was a young kid, my family and I, we traveled not a ton, but we went on really cool trips. We didn't necessarily go on a vacation every year. It was just my mom and my dad and me. We didn't go on a big vacation all the time. But when we did go, we usually went on a really nice one. And so it was kind of like, okay, let's, we would do, in fact, I believe that my family, me and my mom and my dad, I think we invented the staycation long before it was ever a thing. You know, back then, everything didn't have a title. Today, everything needs a title. People in their jobs certainly need titles. Everything needs a title. People need a title. They're an influencer. They're this, they're that. Everybody needs some kind of designation, especially in this media savvy and media saturated world. Everybody has an Instagram page or a Facebook page. It seems like everybody has a podcast today. We're all branding ourselves. And so everybody needs some kind of a title. And so do things need a title as well. We're always titling things. They need to have some official designation. And over the last, I would maybe say even a couple of decades, there's this idea of a staycation suddenly got a title. This behavior got a title. Everything, even behaviors now get titles. And back when I was a little kid, if you stayed around the house instead of going on a vacation, or you went for a weekend around the house, then you just went for a weekend around the house. But not anymore. Not in the 21st century. Whatever you do, it needs an official title. And so the idea of having a vacation but staying at home or in your immediate area as opposed to leaving the state, leaving the country, that's a real vacation. And a staycation is kind of like a getaway without getting away. It's getting away from your home but not traveling too far. It's a staycation. It's probably less expensive, certainly. You don't need the airfare and all the other hotel, you know, well, you might need a hotel fare, but, you know, you don't need the airfare, which is always a major part and things like that. It's usually within driving distance. That's the whole idea. But, yeah, my family and I, we did vacations and we did staycations. Vacations were always something. That was always a term, but I think that we helped, at least we did them before they had a name. I think we were groundbreakers. As I said, when we went on vacations, we went with my extended family, aunts and uncles and cousins, usually had a very big crowd, 8 to 10, 12 people, big crowd, big group of family members. Was just, like I said, my mom and dad and me. So we often did a lot of things with my extended family. And going on some pretty cool vacations was one of those things. Now, like I said, not every year, not all the time, but when we did, we did it pretty cool. And I think that was probably one reason why I have been so attracted to travel? Because at a young age, I was exposed to it. I don't know if I fully appreciated the entire experience, especially in today's world. We always like to go to a new place, whether it's a new city or a new state or even a new country, and you like to immerse yourself in the culture and really get a feel for it. I mean, we all do touristy things. That's a commonplace. But then we also, you know, like to go to off the beaten path or go to not just touristy restaurants, but maybe authentic restaurants. Maybe when you always hear people talk about, well, this is where the locals go. And that always sort of turns my ear. So, yeah, I mean, when you go to a place, whether it's a new city, a new state, a new country, you certainly do and should, I believe, go to some of the touristy spots. That's one reason why these areas are appealing and attractive, and you like to visit these well-known sites that you've seen. As I've shared many of my vacations with you here on the podcast. One of the more recent ones was a couple of years ago when we went to the Great Pyramids. Always wanted to go to the Great Pyramids in Egypt. And you don't go to Egypt and don't go to the pyramids. You go there and you try to immerse yourself in the culture as well. But then you certainly go to those sites that are the magnets that drive you to those places. You may discover other things while you're there, but you certainly shouldn't be afraid to be a tourist and go to the spots. If you go to Italy, yeah, you should go to the Vatican. You know, you should see some of the great works of art, like the Last Supper or Michelangelo's David or the Sistine Chapel or the Trevi Fountain or the Spanish Steps. To go to Rome and things like that, yes, you should. If you go to London, you should see Parliament and Big Ben, and you should see the Thames, and you should see Buckingham Palace. Yes, you should go. And so, as a young kid, we did that as well, certainly. But as I've gotten older, as I've said, I think I've also had a greater appreciation for seeing new places and understanding the cultures, and I just enjoy traveling. I have to be honest, the older you get, it becomes a little more of a drudgery is not the right word. But, you know, when you're younger, you can't wait to go. Your packing is no big deal. Getting there, you know, going through the rigmarole of all the different things, whether it's airports and cabs and parking lots and whatever you may do to get there. The older, a little older you get, that becomes a little more stale. But I always look forward to the destination and all those other things that are necessary evils to get to that destination. I don't get angry. I try to keep my cool. I still get excited about going on a plane. It's still kind of a cool experience. I've been doing it since I was a little kid, though. We went on a plane back when that was still kind of a new thing. In the mid-70s, early to mid-70s. That was still not a commonplace. Now, everybody's on a plane. But that was still somewhat of an, not exclusive, but it wasn't as standard. Nowadays, if you think about it, you don't really even see, you still see some, but not as much as there used to be. Back in the 70s and 80s, there used to be so many airline commercials because it was still, especially in the 70s, it was still a growing business. It wasn't as established. I mean, that was 50 years ago now. But, you know, people were still afraid to fly. There was a safety factor in many people's minds. There were frequent plane crashes in the 60s and 70s. You know, well-known people, Buddy Holly died in 1959. There were still questions. Then in the 70s, of course, this new phenomenon of hijackings where terrorist groups would literally hijack a plane and take it somewhere. So travel by plane, while certainly was established as a travel mode, it wasn't as ingrained as it is today. There was still, I remember being a little kid and being on a plane, and when the plane landed, the entire plane would clap. It was like, I think it was kind of like a release, but they were literally clapping as if, oh, you got us here safely. We didn't crash. There was really a fear factor involved in plane travel with the average person. I think, you know, business people certainly took to it, and it wasn't, but the average person didn't fly three or four, even one time a year. This was a big deal back in the 70s, and the airline industry was trying to attract people. You know, initially, it was kind of an exclusive thing. If you look at airplane travel in the 60s, it was like going to a fine restaurant. You know, people were dressed up, and there were cocktails, and it was like a social type of thing. Today, it's like a bus. They load them in, they take off, and they unload them. But initially, air travel was elite in some ways. They created this this pampered atmosphere. There was even in the early mid 70s the big cool new plane was the 747. Now later there was the Concorde, which was like the ultimate speed plane, which they don't even make anymore. It went transatlantically from New York, I believe, to either Paris or London. I think it was New York to Paris in like, you know, 3 hours, which is amazing when you think that it usually takes about 7 or 8. And that was certainly an elite kind of thing that wasn't cheap. But even for the quote-unquote average person, the airlines were trying to attract the average person. They wanted to take initially, yeah, it was costly as it all technologies are. When new technologies happen, they are costly and then they go down. I've mentioned many times how I watch old reruns of The Price is Right from the 80s. It's on Buzzer, the cable station Buzzer. And, you know, back in the 70s, or that was from the 80s. But you, for instance, when you look at the price of a television in the 80s, a 25-inch tube, no HD, no flat screen, it's a big honking tube kind of a television. There's some people right now that don't even know what I'm talking about. They've never seen one. Or they may have seen one in a picture, but they don't even know because people at this point have all grown up with flat screen televisions. There's a whole generation that has grown up with flat screen everything. But those of us who are old enough to remember the big old honking, you know, 500-pound tube televisions, on The Price is Right, for instance, from the 80s, there's like 21-inch, 25-inch is a big deal. A 25-inch set was a big deal. And these sets for like 20 or 25-inch sets were over $1,000. 25-inch. Hardly any technology. You know, maybe a remote control. But not like today. And when you look at the price of televisions today, you can get a 50-inch, twice the size of this, for like $500. It's amazing. And you're like, wow, what a difference. So whenever a technology is new, it's expensive. And then as it becomes more accepted, the price begins to go down. Mike, what the heck? Now you can get 90-inch screens. It's amazing. And that's the way air travel was. It was certainly very expensive. And it was more aimed at a more elite kind of upper class, because those are the people that could afford it. But the airlines, I think, by the 70s realized that they needed to attract the middle class. They needed to make this affordable and appealing. And they did have to fight that fear factor. And so they began to have these air fare wars to get the prices down to appeal to a more middle class as opposed to just an elite class, to expand the business, which they have certainly done now. I mean, you go on a plane today and it's a microcosm of society. This is not just an elitist thing at all. As I said, it's almost like a bus. It's everybody's on. They're just loading them in and flying them away. And so I remember the 747 was like this new, bigger plane, and it was meant to appeal to people and to get, you know, once again, to get them to fly more. And the cool thing about this was that it had a lounge. Can you believe this? An airplane had a lounge. It literally had stairs. And there, I think there might be some of these still around. I mean, they've got to be 50 years old, but that was a big deal. They had a lounge, and I think if you had a certain, I don't know, once again, that may have been something of an elite, I'm not sure. But I think you had to have a certain level of ticket. I don't know how it worked. I was a little kid, but they had a lounge. You walked upstairs, and there was kind of a lounge to help the flight go by, especially, I think it was mostly on continental flights, you know, from one side of the other, longer flights. Shorter flights didn't have it, but the big flights that took longer, that had more people on there, they had this lounge. And they actually had, like, entertainment. They had, like, people playing an organ, like, music. And I remember as a little kid, they this is back in the early 70s, mid-70s, they had like arcade things. They had the first ruminations of Pong. And no, some people don't even know what the hell I'm talking about. But there's some people that do. Pong, the little blippy tennis game, which is really, really one of the first commercial video games, was just, you know, a little square and two little bars. And that's how you played tennis, sort of. I mean, what a game that was. But it was high tech. But they had one of those that you see sometimes in bars or something, or in lounges, where it's almost like a piece of furniture. It's down on the ground. It's not a stand up arcade machine, but somewhere it's almost like in a table where you look down into it. And they had those in there. And I remember when we had to fly on this one trip that I'm going to talk about here, we were on that plane. It was a big deal. And I remember me and my cousin, we went up there and we played Pong. Wow, this was so cool. And so my family and I, as I said, we didn't travel all the time. We didn't have these kind of really big vacations every year, but we did try to go every couple of years. And then we stayed around town. Me and my mom and my dad would just kind of go to a hotel for a weekend or three or four or five days, sit around the pool and go out to dinner some places but just stay in the Chicago area, either the suburbs or the city and things like that. A staycation. I think we were staycation pioneers. But at the same time, we did go on these kind of really cool trips that I think really instilled into me a love and a passion for traveling. And when I became older and I had the freedom to do it, that's when I really started to travel quite a bit. I traveled a little when I was in my 20s, but not a lot. I never went on a spring break, for instance, in college. I was always working. I always had a part-time job and It wasn't until my 20s when I got into college that I started to do a little more traveling. And then when I got married into my late 20s, we really started to travel, starting with, I think, our honeymoon. We went to London for our honeymoon. And it was then where I was like, no, you know, I want to start seeing some really cool places. And we've been doing that ever since. And one of the places that we went to when I was like 9 years old, in the mid 70s, when it was still kind of a newish thing, the show Hawaii Five-0, which a lot of people don't even know what I'm talking about, but there's a very popular show in the late 60s and through the mid 70s called Hawaii Five-0, which was basically a cop show, no different than any other police show. The big, you know, twist on Hawaii Five-0, of course, was that it was held and it was based in Hawaii, and it was shot on location in Hawaii. Now, you have to remember, I mean, in today's world, we say, okay, Hawaii is still a big trip. There's no question. It's still a big deal to go to Hawaii. It's still a beautiful place, and it's a destination. It's a dream vacation for many people. But back in the early to mid-70s, it was still something exotic. You have to remember that Hawaii only became a state in 1959. So by the mid-70s, Hawaii was only a state for like 15 years. And really, Hawaii as a destination, I mean, what's ironic, it's a weird twist of fate. But I would say to the average American, if not for the attack at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, I would wonder if Hawaii even would have become a state, ultimately. Hawaii was a territory. We had an agreement with them. We had our military bases there. We had our ships based in Pearl Harbor in Hawaii to be closer to the Pacific arena. During those times, especially during World War II, to get closer to the Pacific and the Pacific Rim, your Chinas and your Japans and your Koreas and things like that, we had bases out in the Pacific. We certainly were close enough to some extent to the Atlantic, but the Pacific on the other side, we needed bases there. And so we had arrangements with Hawaii, which was not a state at the time. It was a territory that we had a relationship with. But I think that the attack on Pearl Harbor was so devastating to the United States, as well as so unifying for the United States, in that it not only it drew our anger. It was a shock. It was a disappointment. It made us angry. It united our country. It entered us into World War II. You have to remember, in World War II, the United States was very hesitant to enter. We felt that, you know, we somewhat, you know, got brought into a skirmish during World War I, which was basically a European skirmish that we were ultimately brought into. It was different. It was across the Atlantic. But as it began to escalate, all major powers were compelled to enter it. But America was still, you know, and don't forget, in World War One, in 1914 and 1917, World War One, that was, you know, America wasn't all that old yet. We were a big country. We were a growing country, but we weren't considered the world superpower that we are now. Far from it. And in many respects, America was an isolationist country. We were like, hey, you know, we've got our own problems here. we were still by by the time World War One started, we were still kind of, it was 50 years away from a civil war. We were still trying to get our own house in business in order. We still are, sadly. more than 100 years, after the Civil War, 100 plus, but we were somewhat isolationist. And when we got into World War One, it was the war that was supposed to end all wars. And we were very hesitant to get into World War Two. It's like, oh, here we go again. 30 years later, skirmishes again in Europe. You know what? We did our part. Let them handle it. And we did not rush in. Certainly, allies like Britain and Russia, yes, Russia were our allies. People don't realize that or understand that, but Russia was our ally in World War II. Post-World War II is when they became an enemy, but during World War II, Russia was an ally of the United States. So we were hesitant to get in, even though Russia and England were asking us to get in. But when the attack on Pearl Harbor, on Oahu, the most populated of the Hawaiian Islands, then that was a galvanizing moment in American history. And I don't even think the Japanese realized the, I don't even know the word, I guess the, what the eruption that they caused within this country. Interestingly enough, they weren't necessarily bombing the United States to get into World War II. They were bombing the United States because they were battling for some territories that the United States was involved in the Pacific, and they felt that if they could weaken the United States, that they would have an easier time taking over the Japanese, taking over some Chinese territories. So they wanted to weaken us, since they knew we were already in the Pacific. They wanted to weaken us so they can get into the China without much of a problem, without U.S. interference, because we, ironically, were allies of China. Don't you love this? Now we are enemies of China. We are allies of Japan. It's crazy. We were allies of Russia during World War II. Now we are enemies of Russia. And go try to figure out world politics, right? But at the time, the Japanese were not so much looking to enter us into World War II, but they were looking to weaken us in our Pacific area in order to make their little job easier when they wanted to take over some areas of China. But that bombing in Pearl Harbor was so devastating and such a surprise, and especially in Hawaii, which was this, you know, this very docile, this tropical area, and to have, you know, just decimated the United States battleships was angering and embarrassing and shocking, and it galvanized this country in a way that I don't think the Japanese really understood or thought they would, because we were kind of complacent and we were a little isolationist. And so the Japanese probably felt, well, the Americans aren't really going to get involved in this, and the people are not going to rally. They're very anti-World War II. They don't want to get involved. They're worried about themselves. So this will just be, you know, it's not on the mainland of the United States. It's far off into the Pacific. Even though it's the United States base, it's not like we're attacking their country, and they won't really care. But that attack at Pearl Harbor was so devastating and so shocking and so deliberate that it galvanized the country. and pissed everybody off, really. And the country united like it had never united before, and I don't know if it ever will unite like that again, considering where we are today. But the Japanese underestimated the United States' ability to galvanize, not only to support it. The day after Pearl Harbor, there were more people who, forget the draft, I mean, the draft was around, but people joined. I mean, people signed up. There was no need for recruitment in World War II. The day after Pearl Harbor, young men lied about their age. They wanted to go over there and fight. This country was upset and angry. And not only did our military almost literally overnight spring into action, and obviously when Roosevelt made his famous speech, December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy, and officially asked Congress to declare war after the attack, and that's what got us into World War II. But not only was there a rush at that time, it was all in terms of fighting, it was an all male military. But not only did men of all ages run to join the army, as well as the draft happening, but the United States manufacturing, United States, the average American, felt that this was a war we need. You know, World War II, World War I happened over there. We weren't attacked. We were helping other people out. We lost a lot of lives, and we said, we're tired of that. We don't want to do that again. We never felt like we were threatened, but now we were not only threatened, we were attacked. And you don't do that to us. And so we sprung into action, and within a year, United States was producing planes and ammunition and tanks and all types of artillery. You had manufacturing plants of companies that were completely converted for the war effort. Ironically, the country was still in a depression. You have to understand that. That's another reason why Japan said, well, they're not going to go to war. They're in a depression. We had been in a major depression in this country from 1929 when the stock market crashed until 1941, still in a depression. People don't realize that today. We're talking about inflation and recession, and it happens for a year, and people are like, oh, boy, this is terrible. And the depression in this country was happening for more than a decade. People out of work. Low wages. The depression. What got America out of the depression? While it certainly put people to work, like you hear about the Roosevelt New Deal, creating highways and infrastructure and all this other things. It put people to work. The government created jobs, but ultimately those jobs ended. And it couldn't create enough jobs for the whole country. It helped. But what really helped was World War II. World War II stopped the American Depression, because all of these manufacturing companies needed people. They were all transitioned to create, and they got military contracts, and they needed people to work in these plants. They were hiring for the first time in a decade or so. Many women went to work in these factories because most of the men were being drafted to go to the war. It completely changed our economy. But it was World War II, and the war machine, if you will, the manufacturing needed to fight in World War II that rejiggered the entire economy. It wasn't the New Deal. It was World War II that got us out of the Depression. And so it was ironic that that this tragedy actually wound up in many ways influencing the United States in such a positive way. And it also elevated our standing as a world power. We showed the world that we were capable of, especially at the end of World War II when we dropped the bomb on Japan. We told the world that don't mess with us anymore. The United States suddenly was a major player on the world stage after World War II and during World War II. So, there's a little history lesson for you there, which gets back to my point. When I was a little kid, when I was 9 years old, my family and I, extended family, we went on a trip to Hawaii, to Oahu. As I said, it was still not a huge destination place. It was beginning to become a big tourist attraction. It was a relatively now new state. Hawaii became a state in 1959. And really, no joke, the show Hawaii Five-0, which was a very popular show starring an actor named Jack Lord, as Steve McGarrett, the head of the Hawaiian, he was a major big guy, you know, that was his character, in the Hawaiian police. I don't know if he was a commissioner or whatever he was, but it was Hawaii Five-0. 50th state, right? 5-0. But that was the name of the show. He had the coolest theme song. By the great instrumental group, The Ventures. He had a very cool opening with that cool theme song of showing how beautiful Hawaii was. The hula dancers, the palm trees, the ocean, the beaches, the blue sky. Oh, amidst some of the action of Hawaii Five-0. But it was that show, what you couldn't have asked for a better PR and tourist film than the weekly episode of Hawaii Five-0. It was filmed on location, Hawaii. And that show was responsible for Americans, especially, to discover how beautiful the Hawaiian Islands were firsthand by watching it on TV. Now, don't forget, as I said before, ironically, the bombing at Pearl Harbor opened up our attention and our recognition of Hawaii, which probably was not on people's radar screen. Before the average person in 1941, it was some tropical Polynesian kind of place way out there. Suddenly, Hawaii, Pearl Harbor, on everybody's name, on everybody's mind. Now, don't forget, you've got all these young men who are enlisting and going around the world. And because we were bombed by Japan, the Pacific was a major arena for the war for the United States. So many of the GIs were now going to the Pacific, the South Pacific. Does that sound familiar to you? Was there possibly a very famous musical and film called South Pacific? You have to understand that suddenly the average American guy who would never be, especially during the Depression, would never have the ability to go to the Polynesian Islands or to that part of the world, suddenly was based there. They were now part of the culture. And so when World War II ended, there was plenty of young men who came back with a new appreciation and an understanding and a recognition of Hawaii. And the fact that we avenged the massacre at Pearl Harbor only put Hawaii more people's, you know, mindset. And so you figure World War II ended in 1945, and 15 years later, Hawaii is a state. Had to have been influenced by the attack on Pearl Harbor, that suddenly not only did it become recognized by America and by the average person, but within 15 years after World War II, it was now a part of us, as far off as it is. You know, it's about a 6-7 hour flight from L.A. It's not close. It's as far as Europe is in some cases. Go to the bigger islands, the ones that are far out. So it's not that close. But I just think that the Pearl Harbor attack had a new appreciation for and somehow it created a kinship with the United States and Hawaii that eventually it became a state. And so now Hawaii became the new tourist attraction. And believe me, as I said, I know it's hard for you to believe, but if you're a younger person especially, but this show Hawaii 5-0, which you may never even heard of, but Google it. I'm sure there's, go on YouTube, you'll see the opening, at the very least you'll see the opening of the show with the theme song and the montage, and you'll see how that was a great tourism commercial. But people started to go to Hawaii. And so, as I said, in the early to mid-70s, my extended family and I, we went. I was 9 years old. And we went to Hawaii. Just one of the islands, Oahu. They were still, I mean, you know, places like Maui and Kauai and even the Big Island, they weren't even ready for, even Oahu and Honolulu didn't have all that many hotels. And they were just beginning. It was just beginning. It was really in the late 70s and then in the 80s where Hawaii exploded. But in the early to mid 70s, Hawaii was just beginning to become an international and especially for the United States mainland tourist attraction. It was just beginning. In fact, the hotel that we stayed at is featured on that opening montage from Hawaii 5-0 because there weren't all that many major hotels or big buildings even in Hawaii at the time. Tourism was just beginning. It was very interesting. It was established, but it wasn't like Hawaii wasn't the destination that it is certainly today or what it even had become over the last 40 years. In the early 70s, it was just beginning. You had entertainers like Don Ho. There's some people that do not know who Don Ho is. I understand that, but there are some people who do. And he was the Hawaiian entertainer. He was, if you went to Hawaii, you had to see Don Ho. He had his show, and you had to see it. He had a big hit in the early 60s called Tiny Bubbles. Tiny bubbles in the wine make me happy, make me feel fine. Yeah. But anyway, so we went there, and In the mid-70s, I was 9 years old. We flew over there in a 747. I think we were on United. And it was very cool. There's no question. It was. What I do remember of it, I mean, 9 years old, I still have memories of it, but, you know, you're still a relatively young kid. But I do remember it looking unlike anything I'd ever seen before, especially coming from Chicago, right? I mean, oceans, beaches, palm trees, hula dancers, flowered leis, outrigger canoes, beautiful sunsets on the beach, interesting different foods, the music, the weather, all of it. We have pictures, thankfully, I remember I was 9 years old. I can close my eyes and look at the picture. I can see the picture of mine. We've got a picture of me and my mom and my dad on the balcony of our hotel, and I have a Cubs belt buckle. I was a big Cub fan of my friends. I had my Cubs belt buckle. I was 9 years old. Oh, everybody had white pants and white shoes. Oh, you had your flowered shirts, and we went to a luau. The big thing was to go to the Kodak luau. I don't even know if Kodak exists anymore, the film and the camera company. But back in the 70s, everybody had a Kodak camera, and everybody had bought Kodak film. I don't know what's going on in the Kodak world anymore. But they were so big that you had to go. The big tourist thing was to go to the Kodak hula show. Woo! Got pictures of that too. The hotel that we stayed in, as I said, it's a big building. It's kind of like a four-pronged building. Go on YouTube, look up Hawaii 5-0 opening theme, and you will see a shot of that. That's where McGarrett actually is standing on a balcony at the top of the building. That's the hotel we stayed in. It was called the Ilikai. The Ilikai. And I'll never forget it because it was kind of like a turquoise blue and white building. And it was one of the biggest buildings in Honolulu at the time. It was not, as I said before, it was not a big play. There were not big condos. There were not big office buildings. There were not big hotels. This was just kind of the beginning of Hawaii just becoming a state and becoming a destination. And because of air flight, especially now becoming more popular, it was easier to reach to. It would take several days to get to Hawaii if you took a boat. But on a plane, you can get there in 5, 6, 7 hours. So that's where all this kind of came together. Air flight for the average person, commercial air flight, was becoming more affordable and becoming more accepted. Hawaii was now being more recognized, a new state, excitement about that. And the two were a perfect storm, and suddenly Hawaii became a major, major destination. But we were there at the beginning, I would say, to some extent. And we had a great time. And I will always remember that trip, because it really was a trip in my mind that was so different. I mean, I don't care what state you went to here in the United States, if you went on a vacation. When we went there, even as a 9-year-old, I looked around and said, wow, this is like nothing I've ever seen before, as I said before, especially coming back, coming from Chicago. And we were there for about 4 or 5 days, I think, and we went out on, we went on tours. The big thing, of course, back then was the Hawaiian pineapple, Dole pineapple, sugar cane was the main crop. You went on these little catamaran boats, and you went on, you went to the beach. I'll never forget, as a 9-year-old kid, I have such a lasting memory of this. I remember my dad loved to swim. My dad was the captain of his swim team in high school. He loved to swim. When we went on these staycations here in Chicago, we used to always go the whatever hotel we would stay at on a staycation here in the Chicago area, it had to have a pool. My dad loved going to pools. He loved swimming. And so when we went to Hawaii, my God, he had the Pacific Ocean. And my dad actually was drafted into World War II at the very tail end. He was drafted into World War II in 1945, maybe about 6 months before the war ended. So by the time he finished basic training and everything, he never actually went into combat overseas. He was really at the tail end, one of the last drafts. And but he did go to Japan after the war ended, as we were occupying it and helping to clean it up and everything. So he actually did go overseas. And so he was somewhat familiar with the Pacific And so when we went to Hawaii, I mean, he was just, you know, he loved it there. He would get up every morning and walk the beach and go swimming in the ocean. And then he would say to me, hey, you want to, he'd wake up early and you want to go with me? And that became, on that trip, that became kind of really one of our first bond, even though I was 9 years old. And I was playing sports and things like that, but, you know, Little League and all that stuff. But it was really a really special bonding experience between me and my dad when we went on that trip. Because my mom stayed in the room and she was sleeping. My dad would wake up at sunrise, before sunrise, so we can watch the sunrise. And we would just walk the beach in the morning, very few people on there, very quiet, very serene. You'd just hear the you know, the rush of the waves. And he would pick up different little shells that we'd find washed up on the beach. And then we'd go swimming, and he taught me how to swim at a young age, so I felt comfortable. He didn't go way out there. He did. I sort of stayed close because he said, no, you stay here. But he loved to swim. He loved the ocean, and he loved walk on the beach. And I do remember walking with him and next to him and even behind him because he would walk a little faster than me, and I would see his footprints, and I'd see our footprints on the beach. I can still close my eyes and see that. And ironically, back in the late 80s, there was a song that Bruce Springsteen wrote about his father called Walk Like a Man. And the first line is, I remember walking behind you in the beach, tracing your footsteps in the sand. Now, that was most likely the beaches of you know, New Jersey and Asbury Park by the boardwalk. But there's a line that says, all I can think of is being 5 years old, following behind you at the beach, tracing your footprints in the sand. And I remember that when that line just, when I first heard that song, when I first bought that album and that song came on, I got tingles because that image was exactly the image that I had when I was walking behind my dad on the beaches of Hawaii and seeing his footprints in the sand, and I was behind him, and I would see his footprints and kind of put my feet in his footprints. And so the image that Springsteen, you know, created, or at least relived, in that song, just, it struck me. And one of the things that I do, whenever we go to a vacation where there is a beach, I will get up early in the morning and I will walk the beach before sunrise and be there for sunrise, and just as a kind of a mini tribute to my dad. And it brings back the memories of those, of that time, of that trip. So my memories of the of our Hawaiian trip, we had a lot of fun times when we sit around as a family, we talk about them. But for me personally, it was those morning walks with my dad. And so I've always had, and we only went to the one island, Oahu, at the time. Now, of course, as I said, you know, the Big Island and Kauai and Maui and other ones have become huge. You know, tourist attractions as well as Oahu. But we only went to Oahu that time. And so ever since that trip, I have traveled around, literally around the world and throughout the United States. And I've always wanted to go back to Hawaii because it really did have a special memory for me. And especially now since my dad has passed away this year, in fact, 2025 will be the 20th anniversary that he's passed. And so I've always wanted to go back to Hawaii just because from a sentimental reason, I've been all over the place, but I hadn't been back to Hawaii since then. And so I've always wanted to go back to Hawaii. Well, just a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I finally went to Hawaii. We went on a Hawaiian cruise, a week-long cruise, We started in Oahu, and we went to four of the islands. We went to Maui, the big island, and Kauai, and Oahu. And we started in Oahu, and we stayed right across the street from Waikiki Beach. And I didn't even realize it. I didn't think it would still be around, but because I would have stayed there. The Ili Kai Hotel, which now is dwarfed by so many business buildings, you can't even find it or notice it. But that Ili Kai Hotel where we stayed is still there. It's still called the Ili Kai. And we stayed in a hotel a couple of miles away from it. But I drove past it. We drove past it, and I took some pictures. And when I saw it, I just got tingles. There was the Ili Kai. It brought back that trip, my initial trip, right back to me. And we were only in Oahu for a couple of days. We did go to Pearl Harbor. And we had seen Pearl Harbor the first time. And that was relatively new. The whole Pearl Harbor Memorial was relatively new when we went in the early 70s. I think it only had been built in the late 60s, early 70s. It was relatively new, so I always wanted to go back there and see that. But we were only there for like a day and a half before we got on the ship. But our first morning and only morning there, I woke up before sunrise and walked the beach. And I just thought of the walks. We were back to Waikiki, and I was back on Waikiki Beach, you know, sadly, this time by myself. But it was really great to go back and just have all those memories flooding back and walking the beach and being there for sunrise. And it was very cool. And to see the Ili Kai. And it just brought back all these memories. I still have that Cubs belt buckle, by the way. Still have it. And we did go to a luau this time. Sadly, I wasn't aware of this. In fact, there was no Kodak luau anymore, I don't think. I don't know what happened to Kodak. And what I did, was not aware of, did you know that both the sugar cane and the pineapple industry are all but gone. In fact, they are gone in terms of being major suppliers for the world. Hawaii, I think at one point, from what they were saying, had produced 70% of the world's sugar with sugar cane and produced some, I don't know how much, of the pineapples. But both of those huge, huge major industries are gone. They have moved to other countries and other parts of the world. So right now, the number one industry in Hawaii is tourism. They don't really make anything. They used to be so dominant in the sugarcane industry, in the pineapple industry, but they aren't anymore. And you always associate Hawaii, especially with pineapples, right? Dole pineapples. That was the big thing. You went to the Dole pineapple tour. Dole pineapple. Now, there's pineapples growing, but it's there more for, you know, local use or ornamentation. It's not the dominant world supplier of pineapples. And certainly, I think they said the last sugarcane manufacturing company stopped working in Hawaii in like 2018. But the sugarcane industry is done in Hawaii. Didn't know that. It was a great trip. As I said, I'd never been to Maui or the Big Island or Kauai. Each one has its own. We did go to the Pearl Harbor memorial, and if you've ever seen pictures of that, it's this white memorial that is built over the USS Arizona, which sunk and is still in the harbor. They built this memorial over the ship. You can still see the ship. I think over 900 men were buried in that ship. And one reason why that ship, the pictures you see, it was so the explosion on the Arizona was so catastrophic, because by luck of the draw, when the Japanese planes were dropping bombs, they were bombing the ships, which unfortunately, the major battleships of the United States at Pearl Harbor, they were not expecting this at all. That's why it's such a surprise attack. The major ships were not scattered throughout the Pearl Harbor base. They were literally parked side by side in a line. They were such sitting targets, it's scary, that nobody in the United States military raised their hand and said, do we really want to put all these ships in one place? If somebody ever came over using planes to bomb us, they're all in a line. They're stacked up two by two in a long line. We're sitting ducks here. And that's exactly what they were. And the reason that the Arizona, when you see some of these pictures, it was so devastating why so many men died on the Arizona, which is why it has been memorialized, because it really is a cemetery in many ways. I think 900 men died in that ship because the explosion was so catastrophic and so immediate, because one of the Japanese bombs didn't just hit the ship like it hit many of them, the front and the back where they were attacked and they had damage and they ultimately sank, but men were able to get off. But the Arizona was so intense and so quick, and it literally is a cemetery in many ways, because one of the bombs, by total luck, hit the ammunition storage area of the ship. And so not only did the bomb do damage to the ship, but the bomb that was dropped on it ignited all the ammunition in the ship. And so they said the sound and the rumbling was like an earthquake when all of the ship's ammunition was ignited all at one time. Tons of ammunition. And that's why most of the men on the Arizona had no chance to get off. And it literally, people were died immediately because the explosion was so intense and so immediate when this Japanese bomb ignited tons of ammunition sitting in the ship. And in fact, you can go online, of course, today and just look up Pearl Harbor Memorial and you'll see pictures of it. But for you TV fans, the Brady Bunch went to Hawaii once again. It was the cool place to go. It was this burgeoning, new, exotic, new place to go. The Brady Bunch did two or three shows from Hawaii. And one of the places that they showed on the ship was the Pearl Harbor Memorial. And I remember when we went there, I was only nine, but when we went there, I remember we went on this memorial and all the list of all the men that had died at Pearl Harbor were listed in the memorial, and certainly on the USS Arizona. And I remember my dad knew a couple of people because he was of that age. And I remember him looking at the list and saying, oh, that's one of the guys from the neighborhood. And I was a young kid and I didn't really understand. But Pearl Harbor was so, as I said before, galvanizing to people of my parents' generation. Sorry, I've got a little cold here. I never, when we went to that memorial, It was very quiet. It is like you're going to a cemetery, and they even tell you that. But this was 50, you know, some years ago, and it was like my parents. I could see my parents and all my aunts and uncles that were. They felt. I mean, this was hallowed ground to them. Not only did they know people, but that event was so devastating in their lives, and so just indelibly marked in their lives, that it really was like going to a cemetery. And I wasn't really aware of what this really meant. I was only 9, but I knew that it was something about this that was a little different than I've ever seen my parents act and my aunts and uncles. And it is very moving. And if you ever go there, you should definitely see it. If you go to Oahu and Honolulu, you should definitely go to Pearl Harbor. But I think when you come back, you will definitely be affected by it. It's impossible not to be. But yeah, so we saw we just had a great time. We went, as I said, I got a chance to go back to Waikiki Beach and walk the beach like I did with my dad. I got to see the Ilikai, and we went to different places. We went to the Ioe Valley, which was beautiful. It has a rock, beautiful waterfalls and streams and rock formations. One of the rock formations there is called the Needle. If you want to go online and see that, the Needle on Maui. And we went to the waterfalls of Kohala, these beautiful waterfalls. We got to hike a little, and we went to see these waterfalls. I actually walked into the area where the waterfalls were. Beautiful, beautiful, tropical kind of things. On the Big Island, we went to the Volcano National Park. Also in Maui, we went to this amazing crater, the Haleakala Crater. Huge, huge crater, miles long. Don't forget, Hawaii, all the islands are basically the result of volcanic eruptions. They're all volcanic islands. And many of the mountains and all of these things were all volcanically formed. And some of them are still smoking. When we went to Volcano Park on the Big Island, I mean, there was steam. These volcanoes are still active. They could explode. In Kona and in Hilo, they are active volcanoes. Now, the volcanoes, obviously, in Oahu and stuff, those are dormant. Or in Maui, those are dormant. But the Big Island, they're still active. And we went to this Volcano National Park, and you saw the steam coming out from these major craters. These are still active volcanoes. It was quite the sight. We did go to a luau. I got to go back to my luau. It wasn't the Kodak luau. It was the Kalamaku luau in Kauai, or Kauai, as they say there. But it was just a great trip. I tell you, there's a place that I had never heard of also in Kauai called the Waimea Canyon. They call it the Grand Canyon of Hawaii. And I'll tell you, it was breathtaking. I've been to the Grand Canyon here, and there's no question. I mean, my gosh, it's so huge and majestic. You don't even know where to look. The Waimea Canyon is a little smaller, but no less impressive. But this, unlike the Grand Canyon formed by glaciers, this one formed by volcanic eruptions. So a whole different look, but still immensely impressive and serene. You stand right at the rim and wow. So I have to say, I've always wanted to go back to Hawaii for many, many years. A lot of it was sentimental. And not only was I able to relive that and walk along the Waikiki Beach and remember those walks I did with my dad, but then I got to discover new islands that I'd never seen before and was thoroughly impressed, as well as you just got to love the Hawaiian vibe. It really is hang loose. I think it's called the shaka. You know the hand gesture with your thumb and your little finger sticking out and your three middle fingers sort of clenched in a fist? I think it's called the shaka. And that's the hang loose sign. And I'll tell you, they really are, you know, for someone like me, who can be a little intense and very detail oriented, and I'm always on time and I'm always watching the clock and things like that. Well, once you land there, you hear this constantly. Hey, man, you're on Hawaiian time now. And it really is true. There is a majorly laid back vibe there that for me was a little tough initially to get used to. But then I completely bought into it and loved it. And when we were on the cruise ship, we would go to this little bar at the end of the ship where we would just be able to feel the breeze. And they had this little duet of a little group that played Hawaiian music all the time. And so we were away from all the people. At the end of the ship, we got to see all the scenery in the mountains as we pulled away or as we were docked, and the breeze was blowing, and we'd look at the scenery, and we'd look at the ocean, we got the Hawaiian music playing, and whew, I know that my heart rate went down to like 42 while I was in Hawaii. So it is a very relaxing, laid-back, beautiful, tropical, you know you're not in Kansas anymore. When you go to Hawaii, you know you are in a different place, which is ironic in that it is still a lot of times when that happens, you have to go to a foreign country. Well, if Hawaii feels like a foreign country in all respects, it kind of is. It has its own culture. We learned a lot of different things. On each island, they have their own culture. You learn how the indigenous people got there from Polynesian areas. You heard of the major uniting force of King Kamehameha. But it even though it's a state, and I've been to Alaska as well, you feel like you're in a different place. It's impossible not to feel that when you land and then when you stay in Hawaii. It really is a different place. If you've never been there and you're looking for a getaway, something completely different from your reality, I would suggest a trip to Hawaii if you can, because it is still American, so everybody's speaking English, you're still using dollars, but it feels a million miles away from your reality. And we just had a great time. We had beautiful weather. It didn't impede with any of our trips, our little shore excursions. And I said, we had some of the native food. I tried poi, which is a mashed up taro root. It is not very good, but I tried it when in Hawaii, right? You have to try poi. I would recommend it to try it. I wouldn't recommend it as your main dish. And it's not even, you have to even ask for it many times. It's not like it's always there like salsa or something. But it's kind of a mashed, it's kind of their version of mashed potatoes. But, you know, I'd love to tell you what it tastes like, but it really doesn't taste like anything I've ever tasted before. It has the consistency of mashed potatoes, but it doesn't, somewhere the butter taste is missing in the gravy. but we had just a great time, and it was a great way to end the year, especially as winter is happening here in Chicago, to go there and we had, you know, 80 degree weather every day and sun. And even if it rained a little, as they say, and it really is true, if you don't like the weather in Hawaii, wait 5 minutes. It might drizzle, it might even pour, and the next minute, skies are blue, sun is out. It was just a fun trip. It was relaxing. It was everything we had hoped for. And for me personally, it was very nostalgic and very personal to go back to a spot that was really the first big vacation I remember with my parents and my family, and to go back there and have all those memories come flooding back and see some of the sights that I saw when I was a little kid and still remembered and saw the hotels and saw some of the areas. And I just got immediate flashbacks and I said like little chills. And so it was really a special trip. So and I always like to share what I'm doing, where I'm going, you know, and what I'm feeling. And there's no question that our trip to Hawaii this year will be one that I will always remember. And I sort of want to go back. I don't know if I'll go back soon, but there's something now that wants me to go back to Hawaii. I didn't get enough of it. There really is a calming effect with that breeze. You can see why some people just say, you know what, I'm just going to Hawaii and giving it all up. You could see why. If you've ever been to Hawaii, you know what I mean. If you've never been there, I would suggest, if you can, to put that on one of your bucket lists. Hawaii does not disappoint. Oahu was going back for me. So hang loose. Aloha. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 448. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears, aloha.